Namaste to everyone and Jai Ma. I've been asked to speak on the relevance of the Vedas in our times. And first we must get a very clear idea of what Vedas are, what it contains, and then only we can see whether it's relevant or not. So if Vedas are a set of books which were written in far back times, and nothing new can be written in addition, there is scope of no new discovery, then Vedas go into the book of antiquity. But if Vedas contain a truth which is subtle, profound, wide, and plastic enough to take in the flow and flux of time, to accommodate the flow and flux of time, then yes, they will not only remain relevant today, but remain relevant for all times. So this is the first thing we must be clear, that is Veda a written book? Of course, yes, it is a written book. But is that the origin of the Vedas? Well, when we go into the scripture itself, for example, there is a story of Matsyavatar, and when he is asked, what is your mission? We all know the stories and time is short, so I'm not going into it. So he says, one of my mission is to rescue the Vedas. And how is he rescuing? The Vedas have been put under water by a demon, and he has to fight and rescue them from the waters. So obviously it's not just about a written scripture where there are books, where there are authors, where there are seers, but the original Veda, and this herein I am bringing directly Sri Aurobindo, and of course many great mystics, the original Veda is written in the heart of man. It is written in the heart of creation. It is written in every atom of existence. And if it is so, then they will remain relevant for all times to come. But if we make that Veda is a kind of knowledge accessible and available to a few persons, and ultimately this world is simply an illusion, a mithya, then their relevance will remain suspect, because how much ever we may believe that this world is an illusion, it's difficult to live that way, and truly then nothing makes sense, because if I, whom I call myself, is an illusion, then what is this illusion trying to know? What is this illusion trying to find out? Because anyways, the man is an illusion. Even if I say that I am the Lord, well, the Lord is always there. The Brahman is always there, whether I discover him or I don't discover him. So there is a way of looking at the Vedas which completely annuls individuality, which completely annuls cosmos. In which case, well, they are beautiful books. Well, there are people who want to come out of creation. It's perfectly fine, useful. But it will not become relevant to us in the sense that we want to understand. If getting out of creation is the only important thing, if mukti means going away from creation, then yes. But that is a very partial understanding, and in many ways, even a misinterpretation of the Vedas, if we turn to Sri Aurobindo. So what is Sri Aurobindo's vision of the Vedas, and how does it make us relevant? Because it starts with this great bold affirmation, all this that is the divine. It doesn't mean this is just an illusion which is non-existence, but in creation it is a distortion of the divine, and as we see how the distortion comes about, we'll get into the Vedic lore. So it starts with this fundamental reality that there is behind this creation, a reality with a capital R. We may use the word divine, we may use the word Brahman, we may use any word, doesn't matter, there is a reality. The question is this reality something which has nothing to do with creation? That would be a logical absurdity, because then we have to explain this creation and its origin in some other way. Some kind of power that is either strayed here, which has nothing to do with the divine, and which is here, or let us say Brahman, but it is somehow here which is manipulating things like a magician, or it is bringing out non-existent people, forces, beings. Obviously, that would not be the true sense of Advaita. There is a very beautiful passage in Savitri, I cannot help quoting, the one who has made this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitude of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. His knowledge overrules our nescience. When nothing we can see but drift and veil, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. So Vedas become relevant if we take the original sense of the Veda, that there is indeed a divine reality which is not cut off from us or from creation, but all this that is an extension, projection, manifestation, call it whatever, of that reality. So we have two kinds of understanding of the Vedas. One is that all this is Maya, a kind of illusion. Now I'm not going into the semantics of Maya, which originally means measuring out, of Vidyamayi and Avidyamayi, because they'll make the subject very large. But this is one understanding, and the common misconception that has developed around the word Maya is that it's a non-existent, a kind of illusion. And Sri Aurobindo has written so much because it's not consistent with all the spiritual experience. Sri Aurobindo speaks of that. So this is one kind of understanding, that this world is a Maya, in which case Vedas are relevant only to somebody who finds life probably too unbearable and wants to come out of it. So they show him the way. But there is another understanding of the Vedas which Sri Krishna brings out in the Gita, and Sri Aurobindo brings out very powerfully, that it's a Leela, it's a manifestation of the reality. And that's what we see in some of the Upanishads. For example, when the reality is considered as Chatushpad, even in this waking consciousness, it is the Brahman which is expressing itself in the waking consciousness. It is Brahman who is dreaming within us, within, not only within us when we sleep, but dreaming when we are awake, dreaming in the plant, in the tree, in the animal, in the bird. That poem of Sri Aurobindo, it is he who is loud in the blare of the trumpets. He slays without stint and is full of compassion. In the luminous net of the stars he is caught. He laughs in the flower. So when we look at it from that comprehensive thing, and that's what the Vedas is, which makes them not only relevant but contemporary for all times to come, is that Vedas explain this creation, that there is an origin, and that origin is expressing itself, because there can be no other way to express, in various ways in this creation. So creation is imperfect. Yes, that is true. So the mistake we make here is we think that we have reached an end point. When we look at an image of Durga, many of us must have had this opportunity. I had, as a child growing up in a village. So when you look at, you know, when people are making the Durga Pratima, when you look at it, when they are making it, and initially it's just a lump of clay, then slowly you will see that hay is being filled into it, plaster, color, and last is the Durga's eyes. And then the invocation which brings the Durga. So we cannot say based on a half-finished creation that this is the end result, and therefore the only solution for man is to escape. Well, if we look at the original Vedic lore, then this creation is a progressive manifestation of the fundamental reality, which is called as Brahman. In fact, the very word Brahman means Braha, that which extends and expands and endlessly, limitlessly. So the stars and the expanse of the universe is Brahman. The play of time is Brahman. The forces in the cosmos is Brahman. You and me are all Brahman, expressing in countless ways. So it gives a relevance to our individuality, because the individual is the one of the means through which Brahman expresses himself. It gives a sense to the cosmos, which is a projection of the one reality in time and space. And of course it gives a sense to the transcendent, who is beyond and behind it. So then we start looking at this creation like a cosmic poem, and we are all somewhere, or a cosmic play if you like, where we are all somewhere co-authors in this great journey. Then it becomes very, very relevant. So this is the first aspect, that relevance is because the reality that Veda speaks of is not just otherworldly. It is at once otherworldly and thisworldly. So, for instance, there is a phrase called Ihaiva. He is here too. In this too. Iti iti. Not just neti neti, but iti iti. So there are plenty of such things which are there in the Veda. Suffice to say that creation is an extension of that one reality. But because it is taking place in time and space, it is progressively manifesting itself. And proof is in the whole evolutionary process. And this evolution is obviously not finished with man. It is going to go further, because the Vedas, which are written in the heart of creation, Vedas, which are, Veda is actually secret knowledge. The book is only a notation. So the Veda, which is written in the heart of every creature, cannot have a finishing point, because it is infinite. That's how we find description that, well, creation extends above and its roots are above in the Supreme Himself, the Ashwat tree image. And so there is no limit to its extension. We have these stories in the Puranas and plenty others. I am just, paucity of time, not entering into these countless stories, and otherwise it will become an endless story itself. So first fundamental truth of Vedas is that, well, there is a fundamental reality, which is your reality, my reality, and everything else is reality, not by annulling it, but as an extension of it. So it allows us, gives us the secret of what we are now trying to see. It is unity in multiplicity, or unity in diversity. There is a kind of unity which annuls creation. And we have wonderful lines in the Isha Upanishad which say that that is a kind of greater darkness. Andham tama pravishanti ye avidyam upasate. So there is, to live in this multiplicity without knowing that one truth is obviously to have a world of clash and strife and conflict and quarrels, with extreme result of war. To enter into that one, cancelling all this, the Isha Upanishad, which is very much a part of the Vedas, all Upanishads are part of the Vedas, and in fact by a rebel rishi, Yajnavalk, so that's a different story. He revolted against his own guru because he didn't fully believe that is true. Vaishampayan was his guru, and that's a different story. We have the Shukla Yajurveda, which, you know, comes out, and there we have the Isha Upanishad. So what is the Isha Upanishad say? It says, well, if you go only into that one reality, cancelling this universe, then you are in a greater darkness. So where is the truth? Truth lies neither in the middle nor in somehow trying to adjust the two, but it lies in living this finite world, in this finite world with these finite objects, but always with the infinite in one intrinsic sense. One with the infinity, one deals with this finite world. One with that true knowledge, one deals with the objects and men and events. One with that divine power, one deals with countless situations and circumstances, one goes through it. One with the divine ananda, one experiences and faces the pleasure and pain and the various shocks of life, always rooted in that ananda, because that fundamental reality is Sachidananda. So basically, this is the truth of the fundamental truth that we have to remember of the Vedas, that there is this one reality which is expressing itself in countless ways. So then the next step that Veda says, that what about the manifestation? Vedas give us profound truths which are relevant for all time. For example, it sees the human journey as a battle and a pilgrimage. So what is the battle, which of course led to so much of confusion about the Aryans and Dravidians, which politicians still continue to use. So always in man there are these two tendencies, and if you look at humanity, there are these two layers of humanity fundamentally. One is the type of humanity which is more rajo-sattvic and going beyond the sattva. It is always striving for perfection, which is moving towards unity, which is moving towards inner wealth, which is moving towards beauty, light, truth. And there is always a humanity which tries to drag it down, the rajo-tamasic humanity. And we see in the Mahabharata, which is regarded as the fifth Veda, this war between the forces of light and darkness. So the Vedic lore speaks about the gods who help us in the journey towards the light, who help rectify. And it's so amazing, actually, again, paucity of time, otherwise, all the 33 gods, now I'm not entering into debate whether they're 3 or 33 or 33 crores, and all that can be discussed later. But all the 33 gods, which come from very simple thing, if you take the three original Sachidananda, you see the multiplication of them in the creation, then you can come to the 33 or 33 crores if you like. But fundamentally from the figure 3, which is Sachidananda, they multiply in various aspects of creation. So since they are operating as cosmic powers, so if we come in contact with these cosmic powers, they will make our human life certainly a life of plenitude, certainly a life which is better. And this is so beautiful because there are people who say that, well, all these gods are, simply some, of course, there are extreme things that they are simply fictions of the mind. But well, they are subtly, they take the form and hue of the mind. But they exist because sense of beauty exists, truth exists. Seeking for love exists. Seeking for light exists. Seeking for power exists. So all these tendencies of the mind, the seeking, the aspiration, all these aspirations have somewhere some reality which are found, which are based in the one. So all these gods are, we can say, aspects of the one who is infinite. And that's what we see in the grand vision of the Gita, where when the Vishwadarshan is shown to Arjuna. So the gods are powers and aspects of the divine. In the lower creation, they look like, separate. They can even act independently, like in any company or a firm. If you ask, or any government office, if you talk to the Babu who is lower down, he will have his own idea about things. He may ask you even money to make him happy. But there is the larger picture. As you go up the ladder, people are more cohesive and more united. I'm not talking of the maybe average company, but it's meant to be. In fact, for that reason, very interestingly, in some of the high businesses, they keep their own very close ones because they are all in cohesion with the original impulsion of the owner. So there are the great gods, Sachidanand, so Sat, Chit, Tapas, Ananda, the four great gods whom we call as Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva and Krishna, who are in complete sync with the one reality. Because they are aspects always joined to that reality and they can take us to that reality. And as things go down, then slowly we will see that they are multiplying, they go down and down, because then each god has his own gun and each gun will have somebody else. And then things become very mixed up. Mother says very beautifully, these formatures who come. So we have a beautiful story, parable of Mahadev and Sati and the Daksha. Daksha is one of the Prajapatis. They are the formatures who have a set of people under them. And they begin to create their own empires, like many sects and cults. But the original Vedic lore is not about sects and cults. It is about that one single truth which governs this entire creation. And therefore, it remains always relevant. Sects and cults come and go. Sects and cults are like religion, which emerge when there is a need of something in the human consciousness. And slowly, they begin to decline with the founders. And then eventually, at some point, they are dated and they die. Before dying, they create a lot of chaos. That's a different story. But then when we look at the Vedas, why there are no sects and cults? Many of the time, we don't even know who are the rishis. Of course, when one reads, one knows that these were the rishis. Very interestingly, as an aside, the 30%, if I remember right, of the Vedic hymns are written by feminine rishis. So what if, I feel very proud that, there was such a kind of wide liberal approach. There was a respect for knowledge and power. It didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman, Ghosha and who was Lopamudra and Gargi and many of them who were Rishikas. So who were the Rishis? Rishis are beings who had ascended to a higher plane of consciousness. So Vedas speak of this world in a many-tiered way, something which modern science is beginning to say. And very honestly, you cannot understand the world if we simply say that, well, there is only material creation. If material creation is all, then the world is quite hopeless. First of all, one may try to have material powers, but ultimately because we have left everything to this material world where we see only the action of a brute, mechanical, inert force. But that's not the Vedic lore. In the Vedic lore, the original force of the divine or the Brahman, Brahman and the Maya are one reality. Ishvara and Shakti are one reality. And that's what we see in the Gita. So this one reality, when it projects into time and space, it becomes many fold powers and many more, sub-gods or Ishvara or Devas or Devatas. So we'll not get into that. But essentially, there is the divine and his power. So while the traditional Vedanta, not in the original Vedas speak of the masculine and the feminine powers. So it speaks of the four great gods and it speaks of the four great feminine powers. It speaks of the supreme reality. It speaks of Aditi, the undivided consciousness. But later on we see that there was a tendency, especially in India, to disregard Maya, Shakti. They don't even talk about Shakti as powers, as you know, and Maya as simply something which deludes and clouds us. And therefore we fell, because then, well, Vedas became simply books of philosophies which are very good to console an injured mind, but it's not powerful enough to recreate this world. But then we go back to the gods and their powers. These are actually powers which today modern science is trying to snatch by certain means. But these are powers to which we can really consciously aspire. There are ways and means by which these powers can help us in everyday life and in recreating this world. Now that's another very vast subject. But essentially the Vedas see the human life as a struggle between the conscious, between the forces of light and darkness. As a psychiatrist in my practice, I have seen it so many times. And it's a vast subject again that, well, how to detect? Well, we can say very simply, all that leads or tends towards unity, love, beauty, increase of joy, increase of peace, wisdom, all that comes from the powers of the benevolent powers or the gods, or if you want to put it, from the helpful forces of the universe. So now we use the word positive energy. Well, it doesn't matter. Gods don't mind. They are not attached to their names and forms like we are. And all that leads toward disunity, towards quarrel, towards friction, towards sorrow, suffering, all this comes from dark, benevolent powers and energies. Again, I am speaking with all the responsibility, knowing that as a psychiatrist, modern psychiatry doesn't believe in the play of these forces. It understands only material things and material objects and material movements in the brain. But again, I am not entering into the depths of this subject. There are several talks on this issue and writings. So human life is a struggle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. So we have the gods, and now there comes the beautiful question in the Vedas, that then which god should be the leader? So kasme devaye havishavideham, whom should we allow to lead? So it's a very fascinating question that there are benevolent powers. Who should lead? So ultimately it comes to different lords. Some would say Vayu, because Vayu expands everything. But some would say the consensus of the Vedas is Agni. So why? Because Agni is that fire of aspiration. You do anything without true aspiration. You accumulate wealth without the true aspiration. One will, either the person or the coming generation, will destroy it. You build an institution without aspiration, simply because you have money, you want to do things, and you do things just to expand. And if at the base there is no real core vision or value, then these things will not sustain. So at the core of everything, there is Agni. So Agni comes from that root, Ag, which means to move forward, to go. Even now we use in colloquial Hindi language, Aage, Aage Badho. So Agni is that fire which urges man to progress. And if we take it in this way, then all progress toward the height, towards growth of consciousness, towards unity, towards love, toward the ultimate love, towards ultimate freedom, towards ultimate security, if you like, is all born out of Agni. So the Vedic Lord says that, well, take Agni as the main god, and all other gods are there. The earth to expand, which is Vayu Matrishwan, Indra, the global knowledge, etc., etc. But all this has to be subordinated to thirst for progress, because ultimately Agni will take us beyond the gods. So if we don't have that idea that, well, otherwise we'll remain stuck to the power, that's where we have the distinction between Vedvad and the Vedanta, which some people have made too much out of it, that, well, there is the Triguna, which is the of course Shri Krishna says both things. On one side he says Triguna Vishya Veda, so he says that on one side there is the Veda whose object is the three gunas. Well, that's he's talking about Vedavad, but he equally speaks about Vedas as the one which is liberating human beings from the limited understanding. So we have to go back to this fundamental truth that Vedas are meant to, this secret knowledge is meant to enrich man and his evolutionary journey toward the greater and greater manifestation of the Godhead, the Deva that is concealed within him. So that makes it very, very relevant always. But we have, because there is no end to progress, but we have to understand it in modern context and a modern language, because otherwise we have fixed ideas associated in the mind with language. So when we use the word deva, we imagine somebody in the temple, somebody whom we are offering puja. Again, one of the core concepts of this the Vedic lore, which is relevant at all times, is yajna. So again, we have developed a certain image in the mind of yajna as something happening externally in a yajnashala, where you are offering ghee and different kinds of tarpan, and the gods are pleased and they come. And to many of the modern persons, it looks quite a bit of, you know, either a ritual or a meaningless ritual, and that's different ways people try to explain it. But the real meaning straight is this: Agni is the central fire and everything has to be put into it to be purified, to be uplifted. Should there be an end of knowledge? No. So this Agni will lead us to Vedanta. The moment I say I know it, that's how Vedanta says. He who says he knows it not. And he who has not the thought of it, knows it. Avijñātam vijānata, avijñātam avijānata. So it opens doors to infinity. That's the beauty about the Vedas. Anybody who is steeped in the Vedas will never say that I have arrived, that I know everything about everything. Even though the Vedas lead us to that core. It's very interesting in a story of Narad and Sanat Kumar, because Narad has done his degree in 64 vidyas and he's still unhappy. And Sanat Kumar asks him that, oh, why are you unhappy? He says, because I have read so much, I have studied, I have degrees, 64 kinds of vidyas, but still I am unhappy. So Sanat Kumar asks him that, do you know that knowing which everything can be known? Yasmin vigyate vigyati sarvam. This is the power of the Vedic knowledge. Vedic knowledge is not just confined to an abstract reality in the beyond. That knowledge can tell us about everything, even about the material world. Look at the Vedic rishis. Bharadwaj Rishi, he has written about Vimana Shastra. He has written about, he is one of the 60 rishis in Ayurveda. There is Dhanurveda, written by another rishi. Kanad, who discovered the atoms. Their school of Vaisheshika, Nyaya. So all these rishis were exploring this world, making it better and better on the basis of that one reality. Because that one truth, that one reality contains everything. So it's understood that if we touch the core, even as a doctor I can say, well, nowadays people speak about stem cells. Why it is such a powerful thing, though we are still... we are still in the nation stage, and it's good that this truth is not fully given to man. It'll be given when man is ready. Otherwise, look at it. You can clone a human being without going through the sexual process of reproduction. What powerful thing it can be. But obviously, till man's nature is not yet purified, because this kind of a knowledge was given during the time of Mahabharata. That's how you had 100 children of Dhritarashtra, but we see what havoc they had created. So the Vedic knowledge is a very powerful and profound knowledge, and that's why the words were written in a symbolic and concealed sense. So the language of the Vedas is not simple, that cow means cow. That's how we have the interpretations where people have made a sacred cow. Well, every creature is sacred. Every four-legged creature is subtly sacred. So, but that's a different story. But it's because the language was symbolic, because these truths were so powerful. They could recreate the world. They could blow up the world. And that's why this knowledge was always safeguarded in the hands of the initiates. It was not given to everybody. That's how schools of initiation came into existence. That's why this knowledge was not made available to anybody and everybody. That's how, unfortunately, at some point, the caste distinctions came up. Not caste, but Varna Vyavastha. That there were people who were ready for the Vedic knowledge and there were people who were not, because they could misuse it. Later on, it became by surname and all this hodgepodge started, and now we are not yet doing a course correction. We are just trying to please and placate. But that's a different thing. So not everyone is ready for the complete expounding of the Veda. That's why they were the guru and the shishya. So guru was who? Not some bearded person wearing a dhoti and giving some kind of magic. Guru was someone who could initiate you into the secret penetralia of our own existence. So guru was somebody who could handhold you and take you step by step into different dimensions of knowledge, take you to the ultimate reality, join you with that reality, and then make you live what the kind of life which the Vedic rishis were living from within outwards. So the Vedic life is a life which is lived from within outwards, not surface phetni of the mind, which Sri Ramakrishna said in a very wonderful way, that if you beat water, ghee is not going to come out of it. It is only if you beat milk. Milk is, you know, so Vedic language is very symbolic. Milk or Sheer Sagar, it's milk stands for knowledge. So Sheer Sagar is an ocean of knowledge. Well, so Sri Ramakrishna says it's only if you have milk and you make a, you know, if you then do matho it, what is mathana called in English, I don't know, but when you churn it, okay, then ghee will come out. So first the mind must change into a mind of true knowledge. And then out of it will come nectar. Then so Vedic language is so beautiful once we crack the symbol. So Shobindu, of course, it described the symbol in very detailed way. So horse is power. Even today we use the word horse power as one of the expressions. Cow is always knowledge, wisdom. And it's a cow of plenty, Kamadhenu. So there is a whole understanding of Vedic imagery and symbols, which again I am not going into because it's a vast subject. And so what was the goal of the Vedic journey? So we have the rishis, we have the, you know, symbols, we have the yajna, which is about always sacrificing the lower for the higher. Always purifying anything, tendency for knowledge, love, joy, purify so that it enters into its highest possibility. That's the whole meaning. That if you, it's not about papa and punya or good or bad or a moral doctrine. We can enjoy life at the lower level. Fine. It will bring its own repercussions. It will make you limited. Thodi khushi, thodi gum. Or we can raise the pitch of life to its utmost possibility. And then this very human life is the capacity of becoming divine life. Because after all, divine is living and he is in everything and everywhere in this creation, in this cosmos. So if we can raise our human life to its ultimate pitch, then we go through the process of yajna through which the Vedic rishis have undergone and given to us. Then we have another interesting thing in the Vedas, which is of mantras. So instantly we turn to, you know, certain mantras written in Sanskrit in the Vedas. Yes, of course. That was the language. Even the thieves of the Vedic age spoke Sanskrit for that matter. And it's a beautiful language, that part. I mean, somebody has very beautifully, if you hear Pandit Jasdev's, you know, Chaurasya Chauram, which is all about Sri Krishna as a grand thief. So language is beautiful, but we are not talking here of Sanskrit. So the two should be understood. Vedas were written in Sanskrit, but it's not that only that which is written in Sanskrit is Vedas. Vedas can be written in Gurmukhi, Vedas can be written in English, Vedas can be written in French. So once we understand it, we have the broader vision of the Vedas, and Vedas are written originally in matter. In the heart of creation, Vedas are written as a silent language in the heart. So we have to take the Vedas from the book, the scripture, to Vedas, which is there in this whole creation, the secret knowledge, with it comes from the root with, which is about knowledge. And then we have the mantra was speech taken to its highest rhythm. So just imagine, speech is the unique human faculty. Actually, if you see the evolution, the last thing which evolves, at least as of now, is speech. You see, from creatures, for a long time, you have creatures who can't even make sound. Then you have creatures who make sounds. And then you have creatures who ultimately can not only make sounds, but they can speak. And how languages develop, that's a fascinating thing about philology. And it's not, yes, Sanskrit is the most beautiful language, there is no doubt about it. But Vedas is not equivalent to learning and reading and writing Sanskrit. Veda is about reading that Veda which is secret in the heart, as the great poet Kabir has said, jo bolun so ved kahava, jahan pag dharun so tirath. So man's speech can reach that intensity of speech where what he speaks becomes a Veda. So that's where we see Sri Aurobindo, not only Savitri, but everything, mother's prayers and meditation. The Gurumukhi of the, you know, Guru Granth Sahib, and many such scriptures, sayings of Christ in the Bible, they are all Vedas. The pure, unadulterated Quran, not as it has been received over hundreds of years. Some of these original sayings must have been there. Of the Sufi mystics, they are all part of the larger Veda, or the deeper and the truer Veda. So we must understand that Vedas is about that secret knowledge, and language is a means to communicate this knowledge. When we don't have the knowledge by experience and we speak about it, then we create a mishmash. So Vedic truths have to be experienced and lived, and therefore we have also the Vedic yoga. So Vedic yoga is living those truths, realizing those truths, and when we live those truths, then we have the true Vedic living, not just intellectually understanding it. So I suppose these are some of the fundamental truths, and mantra is the highest in the speech, the creative power of speech. That's something very powerful. We know the destructive power of speech. Lives have been destroyed, relationship has been destroyed because of speech. Now Veda tells us speech is not just a means to communicate. Speech is a power. And we know the power that books exert. They can mislead, they can misguide, they can confuse, they can create revolutions, they can topple empires. So they experimented on this power which man is endowed with. So what is the mantra? Mantra is the highest intensity of rhythmic speech. Where is the mantra born from? It comes from the heights, but it emerges from the heart. It comes from the heights, but then it hides in the heart. And from there it emerges, because intensity must come from here. The rhythm comes from the highest worlds. So when we look at thing like that, speech is something we are always engaged in. So to raise our speech to that intensity, that level where just we say that, well, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. Or when we say, oh person, you are struggling, be healed. Imagine a doctor carries within himself the intensity of that high speech. He doesn't have to necessarily do a mantra to heal a patient. He simply says, you're fine. And there have been doctors like that. And there are moments, of course, you cannot change human destiny that, you know, doctors to keep saying everybody. He must be moved from the depths, because it's a truth speech. It's a truth speech, truth vision, truth audition. These were the faculties which woke up in the rishis. The rishi was not just a dhoti wearing person, but a person who had the truth vision. He was Kavi and Kritu, and he had the truth audition. So when he spoke from the depths, when a power arose within him and took the form of words and sound, then he just had to say, so be it, and it manifested. So we can imagine the Vedic rishis have laid a foundation for a far future. We are still not yet there, or perhaps we were there in the Taipal age, nearly there. But obviously there were defects, so things fell, went into Treta, Dwapar, now Kaliyug. Now we are on the upward ascending curve. Therefore words like Sanatan Dharma are becoming prominent. Therefore these conferences on understanding the Vedas in the true light have started. Therefore we have in household children, I see quite a few of them, who are, if not yet rishis, they are on the line of becoming one. Their words are revelatory. And it's so beautiful to see that. But for that, we have to come out of the fixed formats of the mind. Because where do the Vedas take us? They take us to the land of truth, satyam, the right law of truth operating in creation, ritam, and the vast truth, vrihatam, a truth which is all inclusive, all complete, all comprehensive, which is so beautifully expressed in this single word or syllable, which is a marvelous gift of the Vedic culture. I'm not going into whether Om is there in Vedas or not, that's a different discussion. But simply in that word Om, which is an all-containing, all-comprehending, all-expressing, all-originating sound which they had discovered. So this is just a background, a quick background. And so since my time is over, thank you so much. Whichever way you would want to take it, please carry on. Jai Ma. I can't hear.
Hello. Thank you very much, sir. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, now I can.
You can hear me. Yes. Thank you so much for this spontaneous, passionate truth rendition that you have given us. It was very interesting to listen to you and the opening up the Vedas into the language that we can understand. It was interesting to listen to the Rishikas you talked about, the benevolent spirits that are there. And this is a time for questions, so I would like to ask if any of us have any observations, comments. We have people here who would give you the mic if you like. Do any of us have any questions or observations? If there is none, then I'm going to advance one.
Please.
Yes, so I was interested to hear about the truth audition you talked about, and you said when you really have something in your heart which is full of truth, and when you say it, it leads to manifestation. So I would like to know if you have any experiences of saying something and manifesting something. Did it happen when you were a physician or maybe sometime else?
Oh, experiences are plenty, because everything that I have spoken, there is not a word I have said of which in some way or the other I have not experienced. It's all Mother's grace. I can give you one example. Since you have asked me only about example, I am not explaining now. And I am not saying that these are magic doings and these can be replicated, because it has to arise from the heart. So I know one person who had written to me. He was suffering from a problem for the last 5 years, had been going to various doctors. And I don't normally take patients, let me tell you that very clearly, for various reasons. But this man landed up into Pondicherry. He said he has faith in the Mother and Shrivinda. Suddenly one day he showed up and started narrating all his problems. And every time he will look at the Mother and say, I have faith in her. So spontaneously I said after this, if you have faith, you will not be ill anymore. So just this came out very spontaneously, and he was taken aback. So anyways, he went after. I told him that my inability to take up patients, I don't take up. I have this forum called askalokda@gmail.com where people can ask questions. So then he went away, and after 20 days he meets me again. He remained in Pondicherry. He said that one sentence cured me completely. He said, I was waiting that am I really cured? Because it was like, if you really have faith, why are you so much? I mean, I didn't use so many elaborate words that time, what came spontaneously. So it carried a power and impact, and he felt cured that, well, I have faith, and what am I making a fuss about? Whatever went through. But that is one of the examples. There are plenty, plenty of them, which I have seen. The power of the word, anyways, we all know. So when we speak about truth audition, it's about the faculty of inspiration, intuition, revelation. And I think what you were speaking right now as spontaneous speech is essentially inspiration. So I don't consult any papers anytime. So last decades I've been speaking on various subjects. I don't read, prepare or consult any papers, because I wait for the right inspiration, and whatever Mother makes me speak, that I speak. So this just in very short nutshell. Yeah. Thank you.
That is wonderful. So much. Ma'am has a question.
Yes.
Good afternoon, sir. First of all, I would like to thank you for your guidance for the Vedas. And I would like to ask that how we will manage the Vedas thoughts right now in the modernization world. So if you guide me in this session.
Yes, yes. So this is a very good question. How in this modern world can we apply the Vedas? Go to the roots. Like in any, like, see, as a doctor, when I would read a book, I always wanted to go to the roots. How did it all emerge? Not just get information. So there is one way to read the Vedas, is get information, meaning and all that. The second is go back to the root. So what is at the root of the Vedas? The aspiration of the Vedic Rishis. So when you read, what was their aspiration? Their aspiration was for truth. So awaken this aspiration that I am not satisfied with books, with half formulas, with simple, I want the truth. Now this aspiration is the Agni. This led the Vedic Rishis to all that they got revealed. And if you ask me, one thing that we all must have is the fire of aspiration. And this Agni gets contaminated in the company of those who are carrying this within. So the more one seeks such people, that's how the Vedas themselves would say, find out the wise ones. And if you have the urge, you will find. Nowadays, opportunities are very many. But if you are looking for wise ones sitting in some ashrama in dhoti and chandan tilak and doing some homa, you may be misled. So if you have the aspiration, you will be led. So aspiration to know the truth is the most important thing that the gods bless. And then aspiration to deal with life in a better way. So progress. So there are challenges, and we deal with life habitually. We react with anger, we react with frustration. Then obviously, what is the Vedic lore? Progress. So is there a better way to deal with things? Now when I pray or aspire. Prayer belongs to a different area, so I'm not going into that. The Vedas are full of prayers, but they are more in the form of an aspiration. So even silently that, well, I have this issue, and the Vedas speak about the Deva. So God is not just an impersonal reality. Impersonality is one aspect of him. So he is Sagun and Nirgun both. Again, not going into that detail. So when we pray, aspire, that, well, I have this challenge in my life, this difficulty, this problem. Is there a way I can deal with it in a better way? Is there a better solution to it? Is there a way in which I can change my own approach towards it? Is there a way that outer things can be changed? And we will see that, well, it begins to operate and activate. So the key of the Vedas is always within. Within is the sacred book, within is the Deva, and within is the mantra. So when we understand this, and when we pray like an earth, that I want to understand things better, I want to deal with life better, and I want to be in a state of joy, regardless of whatever outer life may be, then the doors of Sachidanand open within us. This is a key I am giving. If you have more specific questions, please feel free to write. As I said, ask Alokda. It's just a, I won't use the word free service, because there is everything should be free. But I'm just saying that it's available to anyone. And any question you can write. Yes. So don't go by book knowledge, that I want to read a book. Book is there. But Vedas should be discovered in the heart. Books are there as a guidance. They are wonderful. But if you think that I'll read a particular mantra in the Vedas and therefore I will solve this problem, well, that's a long way. Go back to the path that the Vedic rishis took. They aspired, they invoked, and they found answers. So let us aspire, let us invoke, and we'll find our own answers, which will be relevant to the present age, which will be in context to our situation. Yes, please.
And, they are from the audience.
Yes, please.
Namaste, Alok. This is Anuradha here.
Yes.
Thank you very much for... Namaste, Alok.
Namaste.
Okay?
Yeah. I can see you and I know you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Very insightful talk on the introducing us to the secret of the Vedas in the way Sri Aurobindo has talked about it. I was just wanting to know that you mentioned about the fact that because this knowledge was very esoteric and powerful, it was limited to those who were initiated and who had proved themselves capable and worthy of using that knowledge for the greater good of themselves and the world.
Yeah.
But in today's world of AI and open access and etc., a lot of these knowledges are becoming more readily accessible to several people. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on...
Yes, so... Yes, thank you. But you see, knowledge is not yet accessible. AI is giving us information. That's the beauty. And I'll take a little digression. There's a movie which you might have seen, The Bulletproof Monk. So in that movie, this monk is carrying one of the secret coded mantra in a little, you know, pamphlet. And he gives it to a thief that, please guard it. I know you are capable. You are the right person. Guard it. Because everybody is after this monk, and the monk disappears. Now the thief tries everything, and one day finally it goes to the hand of the villain. And that is the time he says, oh my God, I tried so much, but I couldn't guard it. And then the monk appears. He says, no, this was all misleading them. Actually, this knowledge is only activated by the heart. You cannot, you may read it, but it won't work. So the same thing applies, and that's why you see that many people, they want magic. They will read a particular mantra and they think magic will happen. Well, you cannot. There is an activation mechanism which comes from the heart. So this is where the safety lies. AI will do, and Vedic lore will be available. Discussions will take place, analysis and all this. This is not going to affect the truth of the Vedas, which is intrinsic. So always the word is like a capsule. And if you want the energy to be released from it, you cannot just look at the capsule and just keep analyzing the surface. You have to have the courage to eat it and go through all that it does in the system. That, fortunately, still there are very few. Always there have been very few who have really been had access to this knowledge, and they will always be there in all ages of mankind. Yeah. So AI will decode only the surface meaning. It will never give us the truth of the Vedas. Yeah.
Hello, sir.
Yes.
I'm Chetan Patel, and I'm a business consultant and surrounded by many technical people, and we work with AI and for AI. So at now, my question, it is very particular to me. How can I use Vedas to bring out human intelligence in the AI time? And that is my question since last 1 year.
Okay, so I think I got the question. It's about AI as an interface and the Vedas as the background, and how it can be used to in whatever direction you want to do things better in terms of AI is a, it fastens or hastens the activity of the human intelligence wherever it stands, but it doesn't help evolve the human intelligence. In many ways it may even be counterproductive, but that's a different subject. It has its plus side also. But if you, the Vedas are meant for upgrading the human intelligence. So that's why, meaning thereby, there are many layers of intelligence which are qualitatively different than the human. AI is about quantitatively, like you compute something, it can do it much faster. It can take out references much faster. But can AI change our qualitative way of thinking? No, it won't do. It will give you information again at an ultra fast speed. So if we really want to use AI, we have to engage in really the Vedas in terms of, in the real sense, the Vedic yoga. We have to actually upgrade our own intelligence. We have to reach that point of truth addition, audition, truth vision, truth speaking. Not truth speaking in the sense of truthful speaking. That of course is a part of it. But truth speaking, truth speech. And then we have to upgrade the AI tools. So the AI is just an instrument. It's like Brahmastra, which Ashwatthama had as well as Arjun has. So AI has to be seen only in that context. It's a tool. You can use it for ways and means by which human intelligence can develop towards higher and higher heights. So now, can we use just a tool to do it? To an extent, yes, you can. Like there are games, there are ways by which people can try experimenting that if one can give a window that there is something greater, the earth for progress. There are games which are, I'll give you one example. For example, we have all played Ludo. Now, this Ludo was actually, if you go back to its origin, now, in India, there was a Ludo which is known as Gyanpat or Mokshapat. It was made by Sant Gyaneshwar. Now, that's a Ludo. You have snakes and ladders. But this Ludo, through the ladder, teaches you what are the ways by which you can arrive at moksha and what are the defects by which you fall down, you're bit by the snake. So, essentially, something like that can be done whereas AI can compel a human by its own means ascend to at least have the urge to go further. Now, this is not happening now. Today, we are giving as if AI can answer all questions. It cannot. It will give you only from the available repertoire. And that available repertoire may not be applicable. Everything may not be applicable to everyone. So, we have to understand, for example, if you touch for medicine, AI will give you all that research that has happened now. But it cannot tell you that, well, there are self-healing methods. Even if it tells you, it doesn't help. Because that is something I have to activate. So we have to understand the real limitations as well as the limited possibilities of AI in helping human intelligence to grow. So that's where we have to go back to the inner yoga. To really upgrade the human intelligence, we have to engage in yoga, which remains an intrinsic process. Yeah.
Thank you so much, sir. We're very glad to hear you.